Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer in Tel Aviv. There was a guest in Washington, D.C. on Sunday as fateful decisions were being made regarding the war in Gaza and negotiations for a hostage deal. Benny Gantz, head of what was recently the opposition National Unity Party, he joined the Netanyahu coalition to sit in the war cabinet, he came to the White House at President Joe Biden's invitation. What happened and what did the visit mean? We'll talk about it with Washington correspondent Ben Samuels, who will also discuss some of the harshest criticism from the Biden White House this far on Israeli policy and the goings-on in the powerful pro-Israel lobby AIPAC on the eve of Super Tuesday. After we check in with Ben, I interview my Haaretz colleague Bradley Burstyn on his new book, The End of Israel, Dispatches from a Path to Catastrophe. All that coming up. Ben Samuels, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So National Unity Party leader Benny Gantz went to Washington on Sunday, which made Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu quite unhappy. You wrote an interesting analysis in Haaretz as to what that invitation signaled, how it showed the White House is viewing Gantz, and by contrast, how they feel about Netanyahu. Can you talk about how it was interpreted?
So it's no secret that relations between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu have gotten very bad over the past 5 months. You know, they've obviously been bad over the past several years, but, you know, Biden has figured that he could manage Netanyahu through this sort of bear hug approach. But since the Gaza war, you know, I think there's been a very acute understanding amongst U.S. officials that Netanyahu is not sort of a partner in terms of U.S. establishing a foreign policy where Israel plays a central role. So Benny Gantz coming to town, not only does it send a message to Netanyahu, but it sends a message to the greater Middle East about this is the man that U.S. officials really believe could get sort of this post-Gaza war Middle East back on the track as the White House sees fit.
They've kind of tried it before, right, with Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, signaling that they like the other guy and not Netanyahu.
You know, the United States is never going to explicitly acknowledge that they are getting involved in another country's policy. And they have also acknowledged that Benjamin Netanyahu is the elected prime minister of the state of Israel, and they will deal with him accordingly. That doesn't mean that they aren't going to speak with their actions. And this Gantz visit, you know, he visited the White House and met with Jake Sullivan a few days before October 7th when Israel-Saudi normalization was in its sort of home stretch before October 7th. So, you know, they're not a stranger to this sort of thing, like you mentioned. And Gantz coming now and meeting with Kamala Harris and Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and members of Congress, it really does send a signal that Gantz is viewed as sort of the adult in the room.
And then, almost at the same time as this Gantz visit, we have a pretty strong declaration from Vice President Kamala Harris. What did Harris say, and how does it diverge from what we've heard publicly from the Biden White House previously?
You know, I think a lot of people are sort of misreading her message when she called for an immediate ceasefire. So what she was actually saying was an immediate ceasefire that would last for 6 weeks, and it sort of goes along with what U.S. officials have been saying in recent days, that it's really, the deal is for Hamas to accept at this point. Israel has effectively accepted the deal. However, everything that Vice President Harris said about the Gaza humanitarian crisis, it really sort of captured the growing alarm and dissatisfaction that the United States is having with Israel in terms of not allowing aid in terms of not having a deconfliction mechanism for how aid is distributed, for targeting security forces that are accompanying aid convoys throughout Gaza. And, you know, her remarks really should be viewed as sort of a hinge moment where the United States is really sort of sharpening its public rhetoric from the highest of levels when it comes to Israel. Whether or not that actually manifests into action remains to be seen, but her speech definitely signals a change forthcoming.
So what does it say, speaking of action, that the U.S. airdropped some aid into Gaza, albeit, of course, it said it had Israeli cooperation, but what does it say that the U.S. took that move and made that move? Is this a political thing? Do you think it was a genuine desire to get more aid in there and feeling like it was impossible to push Israel to bring more in by truck?
Well, it kind of shows the U.S. desperation in terms of getting aid in there. I mean, the airdrop itself is obviously symbolic. It shows the United States is taking its own action. However, in the airdrop, they only included 38,000 meals. For context, there are usually about 50,000 meals on one truck going into Gaza. So the United States wants to see hundreds of trucks going in every day. 38,000 meals is not even a drop in the bucket. So while it does signal that they are getting involved, you know, humanitarian organizations, rights organizations, international community, they're all saying, well, you wouldn't need to be doing this if you just pushed Israel to stop making excuses, to open up more crossings, to let more aid in, to come up with a new sort of distribution process inside of Gaza that is satisfactory to them. And that's kind of what Kamala Harris said, where she said no more excuses. So the airdrops are just sort of this new three-pronged approach where the United States is really pushing for and Lair and Sea aid deliveries. So they're discussing with Cyprus and the international community and commercial companies about establishing a maritime corridor. They're going to continue these airdrops. And then beyond that, they're really pushing Israel to open up more crossings and to really figure out how they can flood the market with aid going in.
We record on the eve of Super Tuesday, which in a normal presidential election year would be a big deal with the candidates running for president vying against each other. This year, not so much. But there are the congressional and Senate races, and we have AIPAC's first race that it's truly investing in heavily this primary cycle. So, Ben, what's the story with this race and AIPAC's role in the 2024 election overall?
Yeah, so the race in question is a race for a House seat in Orange County, California. Katie Porter, who's a very popular among Democrats, is running for Senate. She's borderline in terms of she's going to make the runoff to run against Adam Schiff. But the race in question for the California 47th, AIPAC has already spent nearly $5 million in attack ads against Dave Min, who's a Democrat running against another Democrat named Joanna Weiss. So, you know, it brings into question, why is AIPAC signaling that Dave Min is worth $5 million in attack ads when he is ostensibly pro-Israel, when he has endorsed renewed security aid? And really, one of the only takeaways is that because he has criticized Benjamin Netanyahu and he has criticized the settlement, one of the only takeaways can be that AIPAC has really sort of shifted its definition of what is sufficiently pro-Israel. And, you know, $5 million is more than they've spent on any race. They've already spent more on this race than any race before. And, you know, in 2002, they were targeting a lot of candidates that were very explicitly pro-Palestinian. Dave Min doesn't necessarily fit that bill. So this really portends that AIPAC is going to highly increase its spending in the coming weeks and months in Democratic primaries.
Do you think it's meant to send a signal to candidates about when they talk about the war, when they talk about Israel, when they talk about Netanyahu, that it's sending a message that it's going to have some sort of effect?
Absolutely. It fits with AIPAC's model for the past several decades, where sort of the illusion of power is as important as the power itself. So, you know, they definitely are, you know, using Min as an example moving forward. They already have indicated which races they're going to spend. And, you know, they could spend more. And if a candidate does not sort of meet this threshold of what AIPAC defines as pro-Israel, odds are that they will be faced with millions of dollars in attack ads, which, by the way, have nothing to do with Israel. The ads attacking Min are focusing on his DUI, they're focusing on his record with Big Pharma, and it's from a super PAC called the United Democracy Project. So if you live in Orange County, California, and your TV is flooded with these ads, and you're getting mailers from the United Democracy Project saying that this candidate is against democracy effectively, why would you assume that has anything to do with Israel?
You would assume that it doesn't, but you would be wrong.
Exactly.
Ben, sounds like it's not boring over there. Good luck covering this and the rest of the 2024 races.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest, Bradley Burstyn, was raised in California, went to Berkeley, and shortly afterwards, in 1976, immigrated to Israel, where he helped found Kibbutz Gezer. He served as a combat medic in the IDF and went to medical school before making a switch to journalism. In the past, he's written for Reuters, and he was both the military and Gaza correspondent at the Jerusalem Post before finding his true home here at Haaretz for 2 decades, where he helped found the online edition, and he wrote the popular column, A Special Place in Hell. His new book is a collection of those columns. Bradley Burstyn, welcome to the Haaretz podcast.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you.
So your book is titled The End of Israel, Dispatches from a Path to Catastrophe. That's an appropriately cheery title for these times.
It sure is.
Why did you choose that for a collection of your columns over the past 20 years?
Well, believe it or not, the title I came up with about 7 months before October 7th, because it was clear to me already that the Israel that we all once knew was not going to return, and that something huge had already happened, some enormous abyss had already opened that would make it impossible for that Israel that we knew to continue. But there was another aspect of that title, which developed later, which is the idea of what is the end of Israel? What's the point of Israel? Israel is one of the few countries in the world where there actually is, or is supposed to be, a reason for its being. I think it's one of the reasons why its existence gets questioned a lot. But what happened was, I think, there was a huge change in what many Israelis saw as the goal of the State of Israel. And after October 7th, it really changed, because you couldn't make the argument that here is the safest place for Jews to be. You couldn't even make the argument anymore that a Jew could feel confident in coming to Israel and being welcomed because of something wrong with their background or something questionable about their conversion or something like that. And so the question really became, in my mind, what's left of this country that was supposed to serve certain goals outlined in the Declaration of Independence, which itself has now been negated by the present government and its legislation.
So you had the book all nicely organized and ready to go, and then literally, boom, October 7th happens. I see your columns are now all labeled in the book that you wrote it 2 years before the war, 10 years before the war, 15, like it's an inflection point, this war. So how did what happened on October 7th and since change your perspective on what you have written over the years? Did you look over your old columns and say, yeah, I think I foresaw this, or no, I couldn't have imagined it?
I think that there were a number of columns, actually. They don't appear in the book, really, where the end of Israel was, in a sense, foreseen. There were so many of them that I couldn't include them. We even had a quiz on how long Israel would manage to last, because a philosopher had said it might last 10 years. And on the quiz, you could get up to something like 40 years, it seems to me. But this shadow, this terrible shadow of the idea that that the end is possible, first of all, comes from Jewish history, because in previous Jewish commonwealths, these things didn't last very long, right? 70, 80 years. But beyond that, there was the feeling that Netanyahu could actually survive the State of Israel, that he could actually not only put an end to it, but stay somehow in power without the country that put him there. And that, to me, was a shocking idea, which now seems more and more possible, because the idea that after the worst possible blundering, awful mistake anyone made in the history of Israel, putting all of Israel at risk, there he sits as everything around him falls apart, as the government is completely inactive, as this total victory that he keeps talking about gets farther and farther away, and there he sits, and no one can figure out what to do about that.
So speaking of Netanyahu, I think your book probably has the shortest introduction in the history of books. It's very, very brief, so I'd like you to read it for us.
I'll make this quick. Over time, you come to realize that any aspect of the Holy Land can be explained either in tens of thousands of words or in one sentence. The same is true of the tragic and brittle and vicious figure who is overseeing the end of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. So this is what this book is about. Once long ago, a leader with great resources of potential and power faced a choice. Bravely stake your legacy to a vision of a historic and just peace, or contort and sacrifice your country for the sake of your personal political longevity. He chose. Israel lost. End of story.
So that introduction motivates me to begin with the question, is Netanyahu the disease or the symptom? Do you hold him personally responsible? It sounds like you do, for where he's brought us, or is he just a symbol of where Israelis and Israeli society has gone because they have, after all, elected him time after time after time?
It's a good question. I think the answer is that no one but Netanyahu could have dragged the country so far down and managed to stay in power. And that's why Netanyahu is the key figure. The judicial overhaul, which has been so damaging to Israel, began in 2010, 2011. And his formulation of the idea that Israeli society consists of patriots who vote for him and traitors who do not also started very early, but at some point it accelerated. Around 2015, something happened to him. I think it was the surprise victory where he managed to eke out a political victory and assure his survival for years and years to come, that we went right to his head and something happened. And he looked around and he was both arrogant and desperate. And what he was doing, I think, was creating a country of tremendously alienated people who either stopped voting or split into various parties and were unable to form a coalition to fight him. He also made allies with parties who were so extreme that no one would be caught dead with them except for him. These are parties who could not reach power any other way, and they stuck to him like glue. They were parties that needed money, they needed power, and they needed respect. The three pillars of Netanyahu's, personal ideology, and they got it from him, and they were not going anywhere.
You've described Bibi as having taken Israel apart from the inside. How exactly did he do that?
Well, the way he did it really was this succession of enemies lists that he would create. He would decide that there were all of these people who were destructive to Israeli society, and he was the only person who could save Israel from them. He's still doing it. He still tries out, even during wartime, he tries out various potential enemies to see who he can scapegoat. And they range from the top echelon of the army, the Shin Bet, the Mossad, to the families of hostages, to tremendous heroes who sacrificed everything to try to save people on October 7th. And what it does, it goes through the poison machine that he has with Channel 14, his own personal television station, and various other radio stations and newspapers. And it comes out with conspiracy theories and the idea that they were trying to unseat him. The basic foundation of all of these conspiracy theories is they're trying to unseat him. And if they unseat him, they're trying to unseat you, the people. The people being people who vote for Netanyahu. He is the only person who can give them power. And even if he can't give them money, he can give them respect. And he can go on forever like this.
The first part of your book is called What Hamas Knew. What did Hamas know, and how did it lead to October 7th?
I think one of the things that Hamas knew was that they could do anything with the billions of dollars that they were getting by way of Netanyahu and encouraged by Netanyahu. The money came from Qatar, but it was encouraged by Netanyahu. They knew they could do anything with it they wanted, And they also knew that Israel had no idea what they were doing with the money. That was part of it. So the second thing that they saw was the absolute obsession that the government had with the settlers of the West Bank. And this became tremendously dangerous as we got closer and closer to October 7th. The army kept moving more and more troops to the West Bank to the point where, according to one report, there were only 600 Israeli soldiers left on the Israeli border, allowing thousands and thousands and thousands of Hamas men to just move in and wreak havoc and create this awful, awful catastrophe.
There's a lot of talk in Israel now about people who were on the left, quote unquote, sobering up after October 7th. They point to activists like Vivian Silver, who you knew, despite their efforts for peace that they devoted their lives to, being slaughtered along with other members of the kibbutzim on the Gaza border or kidnapped. Idealistic kibbutzniks like you once were, right? You moved to Israel to found a kibbutz. The young left-wing attendees, presumably, of the Nova concert. And the Zionist left is fading to near non-existence in the polls. What does that feel to you? Do you relate at all to this theory that, you know, people on the left are saying, we tried, but it's hopeless. Look what they did. You know, how does October 7th and how does the war leave you in terms of your decades-long commitment to the peace movement?
At some point, I realized that for the peace movement to succeed, to really succeed, it would take a long time of growing, and it would also take another element, which I can confidently state will happen, which is that my generation has to die out. And nothing is going to happen until my generation dies out with its mindset. It's like the generation of the wilderness, which I think it's overemphasized in the press that many people on the left have, in the quotation marks, sobered up. I think most of the people that I know on the left did not sober up at all. They're in trauma and they feel terrible, but it's not sobering up. It's not changing your mind. It's not, when you grow up, you're going to become right wing and realize that we were right all along. I think it's also a mistake to think that Israelis are doomed to become more and more and more right wing. What people expect is that, well, the young people are really right wing and the polls show it. So therefore, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that one of the techniques that Bibi has used forever is the idea of, I'm going to get the world to hate Israel. And when I get the world to hate Israel, the people who are with me will coalesce. They will circle the wagons. They'll come back to me. And they'll realize that I am the only person who can save them from this entire world, including this big, terrible man, Biden, and this big, terrible Democratic Party, and the United States, which acts like an ally, but, you know, you never know, right? And the most important thing is, I can stick my thumb in his eye, that's in the Israeli expression. I am strong enough. I am macho enough. I am toxic enough. I am bad enough to stand up to the most powerful man in the world and say, I know the truth, and you don't. And that's the basis of his entire operating procedure. But I don't think it's going to work forever, because I think something crucial is going to happen when hundreds and hundreds of thousands of reservists come back from Gaza. Because I know what it feels like to come back from a war where they tell you, you're going to fight for freedom and you're going to defend your home and you're going to combat evil, and you get there and you realize you're just serving an idea, which is the survival of this government. I think people are going to come back and realize, with all the blarney that Netanyahu has fed them for all of these months, that they were there for Netanyahu. They weren't there for their families. They came there for their families. They wanted to make sure that Israel was safe. It's not at all clear that the way this war is being prosecuted, that it's making Israel at all any safer. And for the future, there's nothing that anybody's shooting for. Maybe there'll be a war with Hezbollah. If there is, it will be absolutely abysmal. But maybe there won't be. But there's nothing else. Bibi is saying, I am what you get. And that's why you're there. And I think that the idea of eternal war and the fact that the war serves his interests and no one else's except maybe Sinwar is an idea that is, for many people, going to be something that convinces them that they have to look for some new way, because this is no way at all. There's just a brick wall and, you know, that's all there is, more tunnels.
So channeling my inner right-wing critic, you clearly don't believe we should fight on until total victory, quote unquote. We shouldn't presumably fight on in order to think that the pressure is going to get us the hostages out. My inner right-wing critic says, Bradley Burstyn, what would you do?
There was a chance on October 7th of fighting this war totally differently. Bibi has the intelligence, the originality, the skill, even the energy to come up with the answer. He could have, except that he's the hostage of his government and the fanatics in his government. So they never would have let him do the one thing that might have helped, which was to create a grand coalition with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with the EU, with the Gulf states, and particularly with Saudi Arabia. The price for pursuing that kind of grand economic, diplomatic, and military coalition to undermine Hamas and to remove them from power and to replace them with a government that would actually be good for the people of Gaza, a revamped Palestinian Authority, the price would have been allowing the Palestinians the horizon of a possible state in the future. In fact, if you look at the Biden plan is very oddly close to what Bibi was promising in 2009 during the Bar-Ilan speech, where he talked about a demilitarized state of Palestine. But now you can't do it because Bibi had absolutely no wiggle room. So he promised revenge on October 7th, and Gallant promised there will be no food. And the IDF spokesman explained that their emphasis in bombing was on damage rather than accuracy. They were just putting it all out there alongside all the extremists who were speaking of genocide. But it all worked out for Bibi because he wants the world to accuse Israel of genocide and apartheid and violent occupation and ethnic cleansing. He wants these things because Israelis have a specific, very, very familial feeling about the army. It's their family. And they know that the people that they send to the front are moral people. They have a feeling about Israel, that Israel is, this is the most moral army in the world. And Bibi tells them that it is. So what he's saying is, we're saying the world hates us, but we know the truth. The world hates us, but we know who we are, and only we know who we are. And that's managed to get him to this point. I don't think he can do it forever, because at some point, people will understand that what's happened to Gaza is a natural disaster of completely man-made means.
An unnatural disaster.
An unnatural disaster. And what you see there is eventually we'll have to see it. I was watching television here, and I was thinking, are they going to show? Are they going to show hunger? Are they going to show homelessness? What are they going to show? And so there's a caption on Channel 12, and the caption says, the severe pictures from Gaza and the numbers of those killed have very much upset the leaders of the West. In other words, apparently we're not upset by this, but the leaders of the West are.
I'm asked all the time by foreign media outlets, you know, basically the subtext of their questions is, are Israelis' hearts so hardened that they don't feel anything when they see what's happening to non-combatants in Gaza?
I think the answer is that there was no healing process after October 7th. Israelis are tremendously traumatized. They didn't move on. There was the option of an operation in Gaza which would not have killed tens of thousands of people and enormous numbers of children. But Bibi and Gallant were not about to take the risk of showing themselves to be anything other than these macho heroes leading a crusade into, unfortunately, against largely unarmed people.
I'm going to start to wrap up by talking about your reflections in the book about, you know, the end of your career, but you officially retired from journalism in 2019. You still have to be heard, right? Sometimes you couldn't let the overhaul happen and this war happen without continuing to be published in Haaretz. And just when you thought you were out, we drag you back in. But you talk about your last self-assigned reporting trip to the West Bank, where you interviewed Daniela Weiss, one of the pioneers of the settler movement. And you wrote that you came to the West Bank to see how they did it, how they won, how they ruined any chance that the extraordinary Israel we moved here hoping for could become reality. And you recounted your conversation with her, including the exchange, saying, you said, I'm worried that this is the place that will result in the end of Israel. Oh, no, she says, with the broadest of smiles, but not at all in a cruel way. She is absolutely sincere and matter of fact. This, she says, is the future of Israel. And another quote that you wrote, which is slightly more hopeful when you were contrasting Rabin and Netanyahu, you said, I still take Rabin's view over Netanyahu's. I still believe that the great majority of people here, Arabs and Jews both, want to see peace here and true democracy and social justice. I have no illusions that I will live to see it come to pass. But I believe that our children might, and I believe that their children will. And that's more than a good enough reason to work for that future. The whole book, I mean, you talk about a broken heart, you know, over and over again. That's, I think, if there's a recurring theme, it's your broken heart. Where are you now? Are you more in, you know, feeling like, yeah, the Daniela Weisses have shaped our future? Or do you still believe that your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren will find a path towards the kind of Israel that you moved here to live in?
I think that that quote from Daniela, the idea that this is the end of Israel, but it's also the future of Israel, I think it's actually true. I think both things are true. But there has to be the possibility of an end to what's going on now, because it is unsustainable. All of Bibi's partners are with him because they are all unsustainable. The settlers, the Haredim, and the people filling crapola jobs given them by the Likud. These people are unsustainable. This country is unsustainable. You cannot go on like this. One of the things that October 7th may have done, and this is what I am hoping, is that it has compelled many Arabs and Jews in Israel to come together, to form new political groupings, to form new NGOs, and to work together, because they see each other as allies, the non-fanatics on both the Jewish and the Arab side are the future of this place. Cooperation is the future of this place. But again, it's going to take years and years and years. This is a terrible system. It's hidebound and awful and self-protective. But I really believe that the kernel of something beautiful has already started in groups like Standing Together and many other groups where Arabs and Jews will sit together and talk about their innermost feelings, also the circle of bereaved parents and the combatants for peace. This is the hope of this place. They are vilified by Bibi and his friends as traitors, but this is the hope of this place. And I really believe that out of huge trauma can come some kind of new understanding.
Bradley Burstyn, your new book is The End of Israel, Dispatches from a Path to Catastrophe. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and please keep writing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Allison.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks to my guests, Ben Samuels and Bradley Burstyn, and to my producer, Dan Brumer, and editor, Nara Malkin. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, shalom from Tel Aviv.